I think up until for sure the late 40s, African Americans couldn't stay in a hotel when they came here in downtown Minneapolis or downtown St. Paul.
From Linkley, it's How I Got Here. The stories behind the youth, high school, college, and professional sports journey, where it leads, and what we learn along the way. I'm Corey Koski, and on today's show, a man that has devoted his life and career to promoting the benefits of sports and recreation. As a child in the 1950s, Frank White loved to watch his dad, Lou Pud White Jr., play baseball with the Twin City Color Giants. That made an impression on him. But also remember, for more than half of the 20th century, racial segregation was legal across the American South. Blacks and whites were separated from one another. They attended different schools, rode in separate car trains, lived in different neighborhoods, and couldn't marry each other. In the South, there were brutal consequences for violating this color line. These laws and rules went by a name, Jim Crow. Jim Crow laws didn't extend to the North. Here in the Twin Cities, there wasn't Jim Crow laws, but there was still a culture firmly embedded with racist attitudes. For example, there were still restricted covenants that prevented minorities from owning and leasing some properties. State law in 1953 prohibited discrimination, but restrictions against minorities were still found in many of the Minneapolis deeds as of 2017. This didn't stop Frank from loving sports. He grew up finding every opportunity to play them. This is his story.
For me, a lot of people would think of the Rondo neighborhood as being in an area where it was, because it was mainly African American, so people get a vision of like maybe homes that weren't very well kept or good. But that's not the case. And I think the biggest part for me was it was a safe haven. I could go anywhere in our neighborhood and feel safe. My father was very well known, and so no matter where I went, somebody knew my father, and if I was standing idly sometimes too long in the wrong place or whatever, throwing rocks or whatever, somebody would come out of a house and say, Frank White, I'm going to call your father, and by the time I got home, my dad would say, what were you doing? So for me, the Rondo neighborhood was a very safe place. There was eastern part of town on the east side of Dale was called Cornmeal Valley. On the west side of Dale to Lexington was called Oatmeal Hill. And the recognition there was that the homes probably west of Dale were nicer, but the homes on the east side in Cornmeal Valley were fine homes too. So probably not as nice, not as new as maybe the ones that were west of Dale. So
playing sports in the neighborhood, what kind of sports did you play?
I grew up playing baseball first, and I love baseball, and then moved into football and then basketball. I think basketball was the last, and eventually basketball would probably become my best love, but baseball was my first love, and we would play all day long. We would play, and even if we had eight guys, we would figure it out, and you couldn't hit to right field and all of that type of stuff, but we would play for hours and just loved playing the game.
So what do you mean you would play? Like you just had pickup games at the park?
We would have pickup games, and then later in the evening we'd have practice, and with the organized team. One of the teams, when I was very young, we lived out on Dale Street, and I went to Como Park Elementary School. And so the first team I played for was Front Recreation Center. And I played there for about half of the season, and then we moved to 409 St. Anthony. And then I played for the Ober Boys Club, and it was a half a block away. So it was easy for me to go to gather guys and play pickup games, whether we played them down on the field or on Central Avenue. There was a big open lot, and sometimes we would play there. But I would gather my friends, and we would get together, and we would play for hours.
So the Rondo community was a black community?
Primarily, although it was diverse. So a lot of my friends, were diverse, and even then, on our baseball team, there was probably half of the team was white and half of the team was black, but we got along well. We played and enjoyed the game.
So tell me a little bit about that interaction, because this is we're in the 50s.
Yeah.
And you know, with the parents, you know, like typically the kids can play pretty well together. What was that like on that team?
I think in our neighborhood, the Rondo neighborhood, I think people got along well. There may be somebody that may have been biased, but that didn't really show through. I mean, every day I played with the same guys. We got along. Generally, I didn't see the parents because we were always playing at the center or Oval Boys Club or in the yards. I would know who parents were. Sometimes I would go pick up one of my buddies and, you know, a parent would say, oh, you want to get a drink of water or lemonade? Excuse me. But I also remember that I didn't spend the night at their house and I wasn't there for long times, but they were always friendly to me. My parents were always friendly to my friends. And so I think we got along well together. I think the one difference with youth sports today, we would play a lot of our games during the day. Mm-hmm. So parents didn't come to games back then. And we might have practice at night sometimes, but most of it was during the day. And so, you know, mom was a stay-at-home mom, and we had a pretty big family. There were six kids in the family. And my dad worked every day. And so our games were generally during the day, and we wouldn't have parents watching the game. It would really be just the teams that were there and the coaches.
What kind of coaches did you have?
The coach that I remember most, a guy named Woody Larson, actually was a practice catcher with the Millers. He didn't play with the Millers, but he was somebody that got a chance to go work out with them and catch during practices and that type of stuff. Was a very good gentleman. The Ober Boys Club was sponsored by the Union Gospel Mission, so it had a little bit of a faith-based Christian atmosphere. Woody was always reminded us about that kind of thing and our faith and Christianity, and so there wasn't profanity around the baseball field or whatever. You know, we might do that later on or something, but not around our coach. So we really liked Woody, and he treated everybody on the team. Again, our team was about 50-50, white and black, a couple Latino kids. So he treated everybody the same. Everybody was a part of the team.
So as you grow up, you go into high school, you're playing football, baseball, and basketball. Did you ever run into any issues with racial issues in Minneapolis as you're playing these sports?
You know, I think there periodically, we knew there was bias. And I think at the time, you kind of, and I would say people knew their place. And so every now and then, you know, we would run into somebody, you might use the term nigger or something like that. And we might counter that with some words back or whatever, but we just didn't hang around that. I mean, if we knew somebody was a problem, we just stayed away from that. I mean, there was no sense in having issues. In high school or in junior high, I ran into some kids that tried to bully and did some of that stuff, but we knew how to take care of that, and we took care of it ourselves. As kids and as a group, if somebody was being intimidated or using words like that, if a teacher heard it, usually the teachers took care of it. if the teachers didn't hear it, then, you know, some kind of way after school it would be dealt with. And I don't always mean fighting. It might, there might be some words exchanged, but to let people know that we weren't going to tolerate that type of stuff. But it wasn't a lot. And so most of the people that I hung out with were the athletes. And every now and then, I can remember one time, Corey, going to a friend of mine's house and being there. And he was a very good friend on our high school basketball team. And his dad came in and said something like that. Oh, today I was somewhere, and he said, man, those niggers or whatever. And my friend's mom looked at her husband and said, Tom, Frank's here. And he said, oh, he knows I don't mean it or whatever, or something like that. But still, inside for me, it you know, I felt it. But that didn't make me stop my relationship with the son and who was a former teammate on the basketball and baseball team. So it was kind of like you heard those things, and while it wasn't common, you knew it was there. And I think my parents and some of my friends helped me through that, helped me to understand that whenever I would tell them those kinds of stories, they would say, you know what, just don't let that bother you. You know, you can go beyond that. And then my father would always say, and if you can't do that, then come to me and we'll go take care of it together, or something like that. And that never happened. My dad never had to step in and do anything, but it was comforting to know, because of him going through it, that if I needed that support, he was there for that. So
let's talk about your dad a little bit, because your dad was a pretty good baseball player.
My dad was, from what they tell me, a great athlete, and he made all-conference in three sports. In fact, when I walked into high school, his coach in baseball and football was a gentleman named Frank O'Rourke. At the time I walked in, he was the athletic director. So I was walking down the hall, and he said, hey, kid, what's your name? I said, Frank White. He said, oh, are you related to Lou White at all? I said, oh, that's my dad. He said, oh, boy, state tournaments, here we come. And I was like, wait a minute, I'm not my dad. So my dad, outstanding athlete. He won the batting title in St. Paul in 1946. He hit 600, and it's still a record today. And there are some people that have probably hit 600, but, you know, they didn't bat enough to, like, my dad went through the whole season, and it wasn't just that he was sitting singles. You know, I've got some news clippings that talks about some launching some home runs and that stuff. So my dad was a very good baseball player, and we would talk, and, you know, he was in high school in 44, 45, and 46. And before that, he played with the Twin City Colored Giants, even as a 15, 16-year-old, which was a men's semi-pro team that would travel and barnstorm all the way up into Canada. And so he was playing at a very young age and being pretty successful. And he would always tell me that, you know, like the Big Ten wasn't giving scholarships to black athletes at the time. And
what year was that?
Well, in the 40s, and it actually would go into the 50s too, so he said
Big Ten wasn't giving scholarships.
Yeah,
to
so people have gone back and said, you know, if they would have given scholarships, your dad would have been like one of those athletes that would have gotten a scholarship to go play at the U or other somewhere else, because of that's how good of an athlete he was. And so as much as I love my father and I respected him, and I would learn to respect him even more later, you know, I always was in his shadow. And I say that now out of pride, but as a kid I didn't understand it. It was like, again, oh boy, state tournaments, here we come. Well, I wasn't my father, and in fact, I was kind of a late bloomer in sports or whatever, you know, eventually I would make all conference in basketball, and but I wasn't my dad, you know, and so. But my dad was one of those guys, as I would watch him play, and then there was a shift of when baseball kind of was coming, so to speak, to an end for those guys in the mid-50s, early 50s. A lot of guys, even the white guys, shifted to fast-pitch softball. And fast-pitch softball became kind of the premier sport. And my dad would go and play, and there was an all-black team called Ted B's Liquors that he played for. The baseball team was the Twin City Colored Giants, although other teams would pick him up at the time to go play.
So what do you mean, go pick him up to go play? Like was he getting paid to play these games?
Yeah, and I don't know how much, like when he, like the Twin City Colored Giants, as an example, would barnstorm.
So what do you mean by barnstorm? What's
Well, they would travel around, and they would go play certain teams. They would go up into Canada. And the arrangement was they would go up, and there would be a gate. People would pay to see them play, and they would split 60-40. If you won, you got 60% of the take, and if you lost, you got 40%. So obviously, you want to win as much as you can. And then they would get a certain cut, whatever the manager decided each player would get. When they did that, obviously, they wouldn't take a lot of guys, because the more guys you have, the less money, right? So, and they actually did that in basketball too. And, but baseball again, so there would be times where teams would call him and he would go catch for a fast pitch softball team or a baseball team. And because he was a catcher, I think he got paid like $25 a game. And he told me that if you were a pitcher, sometimes they got $50 a game.
Oh, really?
And so, and at the time, that wasn't a lot of money, but it really helped our family, because my dad wasn't making a lot of money, and I would find that years later that, you know, I couldn't figure out how he held our family together. But
and your mom didn't work?
My mom did. My mother would go to work, like maybe in the month of August, to help buy school clothes.
Okay.
But other than that, she stayed home. So my father, again, on these barnstorming teams, I would go watch him play. And at the same time he was doing that, there was a league called the Southern Mini League. And a lot of guys that, Moose Scour and Howie Schultz, a number of players would play in that league. And that was a semi-pro league. And guys were getting paid pretty good money every game. Like, and again, I've heard different amounts, but, you know, somewhere around $30-$35 a game. And sometimes guys were given jobs. So, you know, if you played three games a week, you know, you were making pretty good money. I know there's a guy named Bob Bartholomew who actually was in the Dodgers organization, and he had a great, his last year in minor league ball, he actually came back and played in the Southern Mini and with a team in Rochester, and he left the Dodgers because there was a center fielder the Dodgers had named Duke Snyder, and he wasn't going to move up. But when he came back, he told me, I went down to Austin to interview him, he got paid $35 a game, they gave him a job and coal for the winter. Now that kind of sounds kind of crazy, but that, you know, that amounted to, he told me that he made more money in the Southern Mini than he made in minor league baseball. So the potential was there, but the Southern Mini, the whole reason I bring that up, was segregated until 1947. So like my father couldn't play in that league, but I think because some guys knew him and played with him in high school, some of the guys he played in high school with, those were the teams that would come and pick them up if they would go to play in a tournament, because tournaments were probably different than regular league play, and so he could play.
When he went to high school, did he go to high school in a segregated high school?
No. Mechanic Arts was a very diverse.
So that was, that would have been like in the 30s?
The 40s.
Late 30s, early 40s?
Yeah, the mid-40s. He went to high school in 44, 40, okay. 44, 45, 46.
That's right.
Yeah, so, and so again, he would play with guys. In fact, on the baseball team, he was the only black player on the team, although a lot of his friends would play baseball before that, and I think the reason they stopped playing in high school because segregated baseball, and there was no place to go. I mean, if you played in high school, you weren't going to college to play, you weren't going into the pros or minor leagues or whatever. So, you know, guys just stopped playing and played other sports. Maybe they ran track or played football or basketball.
So he played on a segregated baseball team. The high school.
In high school, yes. But he also, at the same time during the summer, played for this team called the Twin City Colored Giants,
So how did that go over? How did he play on that segregated baseball team in high school? Like, how did that go over with teammates, other teams?
I think he was very, from the stories that I've been able to collect, he was a very respected individual. A lot of people liked him at high school. And I think I found that same thing when I went to Mechanic Arts years later. I think people at school really got along well. Every now and then there might be somebody that you didn't get along with. And that might not always be based on race. There might be some other issue or whatever. But I think he was very well accepted. In fact, when he was, a senior in high school, he won the M blanket, which was like the best athlete in the school or something like that. And I've seen some of his yearbooks and the signings in them. And so a lot of people liked my father. He was, I think, the homecoming king or something like that, or whatever that deal is. And so I think he got along well with people. And I think for the most part, students at Mechanic Arts got along well with each other, whether you were white or black or Mexican.
So in 1954, there's the Brown versus the Board of Education for the desegregation of schools. And then, then it was a kind of a process. You were telling me earlier about kind of some of the stuff that were welcome in Minneapolis. Maybe can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think up until for sure the late 40s, African Americans couldn't stay in a hotel when they came here in downtown Minneapolis or downtown St. Paul. And that's fairly well documented. In fact, just last night I was reading an article that I had pulled off of St. Louis Park's website called Race, Creed, and Color. It's about 142 pages that I downloaded when I did it, but it's a great piece of history, and it covers one of the guys that was a business owner in Minneapolis, again said, made the quote about until the late 40s, he brought that up, that you couldn't stay. Even some of the people that were entertainers of the times or political people of the times couldn't do that. And so one of the, like right now there's a movie out called The Green Book, and The Green Book was a travel guide made by a gentleman whose last name was Green in New York, that would help African Americans know where you were welcome and where you could stay when you traveled. And here in Minneapolis and St. Paul, one of the hotels listed was the Seville Hotel in downtown Minneapolis. So it would literally tell you where you could stay. In Minneapolis, there was also a place called Phyllis Wheatley, which was a community center. And on their second floor, there were 18 sleeping rooms. So when entertainers came here, people came here, they couldn't stay in a hotel, they would stay at Phyllis Wheatley. Also, some of the ball clubs, when they would barnstorm through here, the Negro League teams, they would go stay at Phyllis Wheatley because they knew they were welcome to be able to stay there. So that, again, happened until late 40s, 48, 49, something like that. But even after that, we still had covenants of where you could live and where you couldn't. And that continued to happen at least until the mid-60s. I've got a friend, and I write about this in my book, and this was a by chance meeting or whatever, but his His family lived on Juneau in St. Paul, which is by St. Gates. And when his father was going to sell the house, an African-American gentleman came to knocked on the door, said he wanted to buy the house. He was going to pay cash. He said, okay. And the neighbors came back and all asked or asked him not to sell to this guy. And they would actually pay a lot more money to him not to sell. He eventually would sell, and the guy that bought the house was an architect, so he was somebody that was considered a professional, and they didn't even want him in the neighborhood. So that's kind of
he was African American too.
He was African American, and so that's a great story. I would find out from another individual later on that people would burn crosses in front of their house at that location. And then I went to visit that house here a few years ago in my research, knocked on the door because my friend said, maybe the son still lives there. He didn't. I went and I talked to the people that were there. They were white and had moved from, I think they told me, Duluth. And the interesting thing the guy told me was, you know, they did something upstairs and I don't know what they did. So I went to some of the neighbors and asked them what they did, and some of the neighbors said, we don't know because nobody's been in that house for 20 years, which is when the African-American family owned the property. So they were really isolated in this. If you saw the neighborhood today, I mean, it's just a nice little neighborhood in Highland Park, but they didn't really want them there. And when the gentleman died, and then his wife was still around. When she sold to these people, they told me that when she signed the property over to them and sold the house, they did the paperwork. She said that it was such a weight off of her shoulders that she was now able to move, because really? They just felt unwelcome during all of that time. So, and there's a number of places: Edina, St. Louis Park, other parts of Minneapolis and St. Paul, as I mentioned earlier. I didn't know, I found out some friends that you couldn't, African Americans couldn't live south of 42nd Avenue in South Minneapolis. That was a big surprise to me. I didn't know that because I was a St. Paul kid. So we had places in this great North Star state, and I like Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I know we have some challenges still today, but I call this home. But we have some things that a lot of people just have no idea happened here. You would think those things only happened in the South.
You were telling me earlier that the Twins didn't desegregate until, what, mid-60s?
The mid-60s, yeah. And part of that came from Sid Hartman, a gentleman named Kwame McDonald, who was the human rights commissioner for the state of Minnesota at the time. And then there was a rabbi, and I apologize, I don't remember his name, but those three individuals approached Kelvin Griffin and said, you know, it's time for the Twins to desegregate their spring training facility.
So what did a segregated facility look like? Do we have any pictures of that?
I don't have any pictures other than I know that Kwame would share stories that when Earl Batty played, he couldn't stay in the facility. He would have to go stay somewhere in town with some families or whatever. And I think initially Kelvin Griffin said it wasn't him, it was really the town, you know, that where the facility was. And I think maybe the second or third try, and I can't remember for sure, but it wasn't the first time, they were able to have the Twins organization finally desegregate their facility and for spring training. And in fact, I've got another friend, Alex Rao. We played basketball together. He played for the St. Cloud Rocks, which at the time was a Twins team. You know, they were Class C ball. He then got promoted the next year to, I want to say it was like Red Springs or something like that, North Carolina. He went to spring training. He was, and I can't remember the other guys that played with the Rocks. If I said the names, you would probably know them from history. And And Alex went and went, and then he said, you know, when things, and this was probably in the late 60s, and Alex said that when they got ready to leave, even the training then, you know, everybody kind of made accommodations, but they kind of let the African-American guys still kind of fend for themselves. He ended up going to this, I think it was Red Springs, living there. He lived with a minister and his wife. But he said because the town was still had Jim Crow, he said he was from Chicago, and he said he just couldn't deal with it. So he quit and came back, and he had a job offer at Gustavus College here, and he had graduated from Luther College in Iowa. So he told his wife, I'm going to give up baseball. And this guy could play. I mean, he's hit one of the – he's hit a ball – that Steve Winfield and Bill Peterson tell me one of the farthest balls they've ever seen hit. Alex is, you know, a very good athlete, good baseball player, but he quit because of Jim Crow.
So how did you get so involved in baseball? Because you've written a book now. You know, you're involved in the RBI, the Twins RBI program, which is reviving baseball in inner cities. You're very active in the community of youth sports. How did you get so involved in it?
Well, first of all, baseball was the game that I grew up. You know, I wanted to be like my dad. I would travel with my father and watch him play, and he never said, "Hey, kid, you're going to play baseball." I just wanted to play, so I loved baseball. And then when I got into high school, I changed to basketball. When I came out of the service, I played fast pitch. Softball, but then we had a team that was a very good basketball team, and we won a national tournament, played in 4 years in a row in a national tournament setting. And then Steve Winfield came to me and said, the Twins are looking for somebody to run the RBI program. Didn't know what that meant. I met with Peter Martin, who was the guy at the time, him and Brian Donaldson. And Peter said, oh, Frank, if you want to be involved with this, we'd love to have you. So it was an opportunity to get back into baseball. And so as I got in, it was working in cooperation with St. Paul and Minneapolis Park and Rec departments. And for me, I'm one of those guys that when I get into something, I kind of get in with both feet. I get a little sensitive about things. And as an administrator, I think I brought a lot of experience to the table because at the time I was the recreation manager for the city of Richfield, and I had worked in St. Paul Park and Rec. So, I with my own sports background, and I was fairly connected. But as I worked with the RBI program, I saw their, you know, the goal here was, in the beginning, they talked about increasing the number of African-American kids. Today, they talk about underserved and diverse, clientele. So they don't specifically say African-American because there's a lot of kids that could be underserved. As I got in, I saw there's some things that we could do better, I thought, and do more of, and I'm getting ready to enter my 18th season coming up here in 2019. I've enjoyed it because it's gotten me back into coaching baseball. And now I still coach, but most of the coaching is done by Steve Winfield, Bill Peterson, and some other individuals that we've been able to hire and bring on. And so I'm kind of the coach, but not I'm the administrator, so to speak. But I'm at most practices, and I get out to see a lot of baseball and softball games. I like it, Corey, because I love the game. It's really a difficult and a challenging game. I see different than basketball and football. Football has its own challenges right now. I talk to people all the time about football. I mean, if you're a mom and dad and you're letting your son play football, you really have to think about, man, is that really what you want to do? Because you're not going to know some of the things that are going to impact him until down the road. basketball size matters. You know, my grandson signed in the NBA. He's 6'9". The average height in the NBA right now is about 6'9". So if you're the 5'10 guy, the 5'11 guy, the 5'9 guy, the 6 foot guy, and you're a great basketball player, chances of you making it even to Division I basketball, if that's your goal, is pretty tough. But in baseball, man, you could be a star. I always used some of the guys that are around 5'10 that are stars and guys that are jacking the ball out of the park, or good pitchers or whatever. Excuse me. So I think baseball has a place, and I wish we could encourage more kids to at least give it a try. I was looking at some stats here last night, and when in 1985, I think Major League Baseball had, like, I think the number of African Americans in the major leagues was 19%. In 2013, and it had dropped to 8.5%, and I think it's even less now. But I looked at 2013 in our stats here in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I looked at St. Paul's stats, and we had about 2,100 kids involved in our program, and 11% of them were African American. Another 5% were Latino. And then if I put all of the kids of color together, it came out to be like about 23% of the program were kids of color. That's a pretty good representation. However, if we continue to track, those are kids that start early, but by the time they get to high school, we don't have that many kids of color or African American kids playing baseball anymore, and I think it's unfortunate, because I think a lot of the kids that are basketball players, when they get to high school, because of their size, they don't even make a high school team, but they could be great baseball players. So
what's the biggest hurdle you guys face at RBI?
I think first of all, we're very fortunate that the Twins are connected, so we don't want for equipment or that stuff, or if we have to travel, those things are taken care of. I think our biggest hurdle is getting kids to want to practice. Kids just don't want to put in the time to practice and learn the fundamentals. And that makes it tough to teach the game.
Let's talk about your book.
Okay.
What was the genesis of that?
I think there are a number of people that that deserve recognition because they were very good baseball players. Some of them were just good baseball players. But in our documented history, you wouldn't even know who they were. And so for me, it was an opportunity to recognize people. And of course, my father was one of those individuals. But I think in my book, you'll see that I do mention my dad, but I don't mention great stories. The book goes all the way from like 1885 to about 1960. And I kind of do it by chapters, by decades or whatever, and speak to those individuals during that time. I'm still today, the book came out in 2016, I'm still researching, and I'm still finding players that I didn't even know about back when I was doing the research in the beginning. So I think the genesis was getting, you know, with Major League Baseball and reviving baseball in inner cities, fewer African Americans playing baseball, hearing kids say, oh, that's the white boy sport, and just the lack of knowledge of many people, our total community, of many of the people that I talk about in the book. There's no documentation. Unless you played against those guys, you would never know they existed. And I think part of it also is they went through some tough times, to be able to play the game, even though they didn't make a lot of money. Sometimes they might travel and didn't make any money, but they love playing the game.
And that's basically the title of the book.
Right, yeah, they play for the love of the game.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show today. If you like this show or any other of our shows, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. If you want to read stories written by our guest, you can do that on www.linkly.com. Don't forget to sign up for our weekly newsletter so you don't miss any of these stories. Make sure to check out our social pages. We have them all: Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. If you have any suggestions for our show, please write us on Facebook. I'm Corey Koski, and you've been listening to How I Got Here from Linkly. Special thanks to Wade Beavers and our friends at the restaurant Agriculture.